Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. By the way, we're coming very close to our 100th episode. October will be 100 episodes consecutively. I think there might have been just one or two where we've missed a week here or there, but coming up a couple of weeks, going to be the 100th episode. We got some special things planned, some things I know about, some things I've been told not to think about. So we'll see what happens on the 100th episode of the OIG Roundtable. And as always, I'm happy to have Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and now a manager on our SIU team, and Matt Kachansky, our payment integrity director, retired HHS OIG executive and retired Northeast UPIC director, and now runs our payment integrity team. So today we want to talk about, you know, the other day there was something put up on the internet from NGS, National Government Services, which is one of the Medicare MACs, Medicare Administrative Contractors. They pay the claims. When you enroll as a Medicare provider, you submit your Medicare application to the MAC in the jurisdiction where you're going to be, and that MAC processes your 855 form, as well as any changes to those forms, individual groups, reassignment of benefits, and the like. And then you become an enrolled provider in the Medicare program in that jurisdiction. And NGS, National Government Services, sent out a flyer the other day, kind of a provider notification. There's a MedLearn Matters document that was also put out. MedLearn Matters is kind of a one-pager or two-pager summary of things going on from a policy perspective. For those of you on the practice side, you really should be looking at those MedLearn Matters documents, because they really do outline in layman's terms kind of the sum and substance of what needs to transpire for the billing and coding and documentation of certain items, services, and procedures. But interestingly enough, so NGS puts out this web-based document, and it's talking about the provision of documentation to support claims for reimbursement that come out of laboratory and diagnostic entities. So we'll call those ancillary services, because there's a lot of collateral things. When we talk about laboratory services, we're talking about anything and everything in the laboratory space, whether it's genetic testing, whether it's blood tests, urine tests. We'll talk a little bit about how this all interacts with substance abuse disorder treatment and UDT, or urine drug treatment, and the like. And from the diagnostic perspective, it's even broader, right? We could be talking about anything from ultrasounds, MRIs, CTs. It could even be cardiovascular testing, nuclear stress testing, EKGs, anything that's diagnostic in nature that would be done by an ancillary provider. Could be part of this. And, you know, one of the things that NGS is talking about, and this is in the Medicare space, but you see this a lot when it comes to prior authorizations, is in the commercial space, is this requirement to have available the supporting documentation to support the medical necessity for that diagnostic procedure or that laboratory procedure. And that could obviously create a whole host of issues, because the laboratory is looking to conduct the test, or the ancillary provider, the diagnostic services provider, is looking to provide that diagnostic item, service, procedure based upon an order from the physician. But that isn't always, you know, enough. And there could be questions that come about from a result of it. And then obviously some of the collateral issues involving provider abrasion, and when a provider submits medical documentation, how do you bifurcate out the order for an MRI with other documentation like an E&M, and then the subjecting of scrutiny to that? But Wade, I think, you know, from the investigative perspective, particularly in some commercial worlds where a commercial payer may not require the referring or ordering provider's NPI number to be on the claim form, or it may scrub it out somehow. And so the lab gets an order, they submit a claim for reimbursement, and there's no information about that provider. But, you know, the greater piece of that puzzle is that even if you say the lab is responsible and has a fiduciary responsibility to have that documentation, from an investigative perspective, that could present some huge challenges. So, in the Medicare world, in order for a doctor to order an item, service, or procedure, even a prescription, they have to be participating in the program, or they can't, do that. In the commercial space, that may not be the case. And so you've got instances where a commercial payer has a relationship with a lab or a diagnostic facility, but maybe not a relationship with the doctor. And then the onus is on the lab. And typically, a lot of times, the lab or the diagnostic facility's response is, hey, we just do the test that the doctor is ordering. And from an investigative perspective, you've now created an instance of another layer of documents that need to be collected. You've created another layer of interaction with a provider, and you've created a time lag, right, on the ability to quickly resolve an allegation or a matter. And so, you got to just deal with these, right? So let's talk a little bit from the investigative perspective, like some of those, their challenges, and it's not that you get around them, but it, an investigator needs to understand when they're getting a case that involves a lab or diagnostic facility, there are going to be a whole bunch of other steps that you have to take that are not inherent within the fraud, waste, abuse issue that's currently in front of you.
Right. And a lot of times the investigator will have to go back to the billing provider and basically request for them to reach out to the referring provider and say, hey, we don't have sufficient documentation to support the claim, whether it be a medical necessity or whatever the review is entailing, that the documentation isn't enough. So they need to go back to the referring provider to get that additional documentation. And a lot of times they'll get pushed back, because it's, it's resources they're spending on pulling other records and sending them. They don't really want to have to do that. And that's part of what this MLN booklet was going into, is where the providers have to look at it as like an overall patient care issue. You're trying to get the claims submitted and paid, even if it's not, even if you're not the end payee. It's that, referring physician's responsibility to make sure those records are provided to get the claim processed. The other kind of angle on it is the SIU, or if it's the OIG days, the government is different, but the SIU doesn't really have what we would call like a hammer to, say, you need these documents provided or else we will do X, Y, and Z, like not pay the claim. Well, it's not a claim that they're waiting for payment on, so you really don't have any recourse for them if they tell you that they're just not interested in helping and they're not going to do it because they're overworked and it's resources and whatnot. The SIU doesn't really have a hammer on that. It may even be a non-participating provider, so we have to say, can you please provide these documents? But we don't have the or else. Either provide the documents or else you won't get paid or else whatever. There's no or else. So that's really part of the main issue there as well that they run into.
Yeah, and that becomes a huge challenge. Now, in the Medicare space, there generally isn't anything that involves pre-authorization, right, or pre-certification in the traditional Medicare space. Now, in the Medicare Advantage space, they have some pre-authorization and things of that sort. But the big question is, in the Medicare Advantage space, when something is being denied in a pre-authorization on a Medicare Advantage claim, are there some inconsistencies in that? Because on traditional Medicare, if it's an item, service, or procedure that would be covered under traditional, it has to be covered under Medicare Advantage. But in the Medicare Advantage space, there may be some issues involving that pre-cert or pre-authorization. So Matt, the next piece of that puzzle is that in the pre-authorization space, the payers will say that pre-authorization is not a guarantee of payment. It is a guarantee that the item, service, or procedure sought for payment is covered. And right, there's the question of submitting the medical records and doing all that. And so theoretically, there's two pieces. One is the provider then submitting a claim for payment commensurate with what was authorized? And then the other piece of the puzzle is, in many cases where there's a pre-authorization, the payer already has the medical records from the provider, because the provider, meaning the ordering provider, is the entity that's seeking the prior authorization, right? MRI facilities, labs, they're not the ones that seek prior authorization. That comes from the provider provider of that service, the
Yes.
rendering facility, kind of the end user type thing. isn't seeking that. But that presents a whole set of challenges, because then the question kind of begs itself that if I'm looking to get a blood test, and that blood test requires pre-authorization or it requires documentation or something in a post-pay world, if that blood test is, for example, cholesterol, and my cholesterol blood test is being questioned by Medicare or whomever, you know, theoretically, you should be able to go back and look electronically at the patient's prior visits with the doctor who ordered the test. Is there a diagnosis of, you know, high cholesterol? You know, and is that enough? Or do you need to have a document that says this patient may have high cholesterol, I'm ordering this blood test? So, you know, there's kind of this back and forth where is the documentation really necessary? Does the patient's electronic record, billing record, meaning, is that sufficient? Is there a combination of them? But, you know, all of these things work against an investigator's ability to timely investigate and timely complete their mission.
Well, let's think about that for a minute. I want to go back to something that Wade brought up and go back to the whole philosophy of enforcement on these issues. But if there's a pre-auth in place, coverage has been guaranteed because the plan has said there is a need for this service. Why do you need the medical records at all? You don't need to go to the third party, or we used to call it third party records, for the referring physician or referring provider's records. You don't need them. You've got a pre-auth in place. The only thing you have to investigate with a pre-auth is whether the service was rendered as billed and was billed correctly. And I'll give you an example of that. We had a case with one of our clients where it was for facet joint injections with guidance. So all pre-authed. And they had submitted the medical records for the pre-auth, and it was the same physician doing the service as asking for the pre-auth. So it wasn't something that they were referring out. But how they billed it was wrong. They billed the facet injection with guidance plus the separate guidance code. Both of those things were pre-authed to be used because they were covered, but because they double billed it, it was not billed appropriately, and we were able to collect an overpayment. So, but going back to Wade's thing about, you know, now what? Think about the whole philosophy of this. Let's say you get the medical records from the referring doctor, and they don't show medical necessity, right? They're just, he ordered this test, or she ordered this test willy-nilly, just because they're checking a box. How is that the lab's fault? Why are you going after the lab for that payment? Why isn't there a vehicle to go after the physician that unnecessarily ordered these tests? That's where the hole is here, is you're going after the wrong party. They're just following an order that they got. They have no reason to doubt, unless you start seeing a pattern of these things, the necessity of the test that's being ordered. But yet they're the ones that get penalized because they do get paid for the test. But there should be some vehicle to go after the referring physician for causing it to be
right. Well, that's an interesting premise, right? So under the False Claims Act, if we were working on a Medicare or Medicaid case, you theoretically have the ability under the False Claims Act to do that, right? Caused, right? To be submitted in the commercial space, that may not exist. There may be some state laws that we'd have to do a little bit of research on. But, you know, at the end of the day, the issue is going to be that the lab is in a position, the diagnostic facility is in a position where they almost have to make an independent assessment about whether or not the documentation supports this, you know. But generally speaking, the only document that a lab gets or a diagnostic facility gets is a written order from the provider. You know, if it's blood work, it's a requisition, a script, it's something like that. If it's an MRI, a CT, a diagnostic test, it's really just a written order from the doctor. There's really nothing else there. So right. How can that be the case? And then I think, you know, collaterally, this goes to even things like, you know, because DME is no different. So while the NGS article talked about diagnostic and laboratories, it's really no different. You know, then you get to even more granular. If we talk about in the DME space, particularly wheelchairs, right? That is the bane, is that a doctor is going to order that a patient be given a wheelchair. Doctors typically don't know the nuances of, you know, if it's a power wheelchair, is it 36 inches wide? Is it 40 inches wide? Whatever it is. And remember, in the DME space for mobility, the company needs to go out and do a physical assessment of the location, because the whole point of using something like a wheelchair is to assist with ADL, activities of daily living. Your wheelchair has to be able to get through the door and be able to be maneuverable within your home, right? I mean, my favorites were when, you know, at the OIG, going out and working on a wheelchair fraud case, and you'd show up at the house, and the house, there'd be a flight of stairs and the wheelchair outside to the porch, and the house would be on a hill, and at the bottom of the stairs was the wheelchair, and you knock on the door, and the person that answers the door is the user of the wheelchair. And it's like, what's going on here? You know, but to, you know, to an extent though, right, a doctor, the ordering doctor doesn't necessarily know these things, right? It's the DME company's responsibility, but right, there is, there is a little bit of a fiduciary responsibility in doing this. So Wade, you know, back to you, is when you're running into these problems, right, as an SIU investigator, you've got this situation where, you know, was this test rendered? I don't think there's a question about whether it was rendered or not rendered. Was it medically necessary? Meaning, did the documentation support this? And you run into this problem where the lab isn't giving you the records. You know, now you've got to spend time in getting records from the provider. And then this whole premise of this provider abrasion, are you pissing off a doc or a healthcare provider that has no dog in the fight? They didn't, you know, they didn't get reimbursed for it. It's not their problem. And they're going to say, my order is my order. And, you know, how, you know, you do this. The thing that I thought was kind of interesting was in the NGS article, there was a whole section in the article about how the, you know, it's kind of playing the sandbox nicely with each other. And I think, you know, generally speaking, there's an acrimonious relationship that exists in the payer space between payers and providers, right? Ergo, this term of art known as provider abrasion. But what are some things that you can think of in which you can potentially circumvent having to go to the provider? You know, in my mind, I think of going to the provider as the last step, because if there are other ways to be able to identify whether or not there was some medical necessity to that service as billed, barring like the Matt example of like double billing or something like that. But, you know, what are some other pieces of the puzzle from an investigative perspective you can think of?
Well, I think one, the one that comes to mind initially is kind of what I was talking about a minute ago, whereas if the referring provider is a participating provider, for one thing, if he is, and maybe he didn't have a dog in the fight before, but if there's a pattern of him or her providing records that, you know, going back to what Matt was saying, they maybe don't establish medical necessity for a certain test or whatever. Not that investigators are looking to, you know, mine new cases while they're working this certain case they're on right now, but maybe that's a case where if we're seeing a pattern, and it is a participating provider, like I say, now they do have a dog in the fight, because now we're gonna look at those claims, maybe do a medical request, get claims, have them reviewed by a CPC or a nurse reviewer to find out if they, you know, if those are legitimate claims that were paid, or we have to go back and look at them. That could be like a whole new case where they're billing for services that aren't medically necessary. So that's the first angle that jumps out at me. And again, it goes back to, if they're not participating, then that's off the table, because there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, that's not part of your investigative process.
Yeah. Right. And that's a whole set of challenges. So Matt, I want to go to you for kind of this last word. I was
going to say, you can look at the data, right?
So that's exactly what I was going to ask you.
Does the referring physician have a history with that patient?
Right.
You know, that's an issue there. Or you can look to the benefit of the referring physician. was it a test for, you know, a glucose test? They're an endocrinologist, and the diagnosis of the patient is hyperglycemia. Yeah, that kind of right. makes sense just in the data itself that this is the type of test that they're going to order, and it's probably because of the condition of the patient. But go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. Is kind of as we wrap up here, the last kind of word on this is, how does data fit into this metric in a way that you can avoid having to create provider abrasion? Also, you know, maybe just a way to get to some investigative conclusion on something. And that's a great example is if the patient has a history, if you go through, they're supposed to get an ultrasound of their kidney, and they have a history with a urologist, and the diagnosis from the urologist is the diagnosis for that test. Do you really need to start thinking about, you know, these other pieces? And this is only going under the assumption that the test that they had billed seems to comport with what the test is that a patient would have based upon, you know, the patient's prior history. I mean, I still think part of the problem in the Medicare space is if the diagnostic provider or the lab submits their claim very timely and the ordering or referring provider doesn't submit their claim timely, you know, sometimes, right, there's a lag in the data. The 12-month rule, I think, is something that needs to be, at least in the CMS space, I think different plans have different rules, but the 12-month rule needs to be revisited sharply, because at the end of the day, that 12-month rule is what allows the nefarious providers that are out there to commit the levels of fraud that exist, because there is no way to independently interrogate data when you've got a lack of a doctor-patient relationship or a lack of medical necessity for certain things. That 12-month period of time is something that can actually be a factor. And, you know, I ran into cases at the OIG where providers intentionally delayed the submission of claims for the purposes of being able to blur some of the things that they were doing, because they had delayed the submission of the claims so far out. Patients didn't have a memory of things. You know, there's multiple claims over the course of a year. It creates a whole other world of interest. So, you know, that's something, if people from Congress are listening, that's something that can be considered, is when you tighten up your timeframes by which you can submit a claim, 12 months is an awfully long time to be able to submit a claim. And that is going to obviously create opportunities in the fraud, waste, abuse space. So, you know, if you're in an SIU and you've got to look at these kinds of policies and you've got to see ultimately what those requirements are, particularly if you're working, you know, in the Medicare or the Medicaid side and you're looking at these policies, what are the implications of a policy that says you have to have this collateral documentation? Does it make sense as an SIU investigator, if you're working on a case that involves an ancillary provider, and there is data to support who the ordering physician was or provider, does it make sense to make a request for records to both? You know, from an investigative perspective, it may, because you save yourself the time. You're requesting the records from both. But also, if you have a concern of fabrication, alteration, or lack of documentation, if you're getting the same records from the lab as you would get from the provider, that's obviously a good sign. But, you know, what if the records aren't the same? What if the provider doesn't have records to submit? What if they send you a letter saying we don't have records and the lab sends you records? What if the lab says we can't get the records and the doctor's office provides the records? How do you handle that? If the lab is required to maintain or get those, not maintain, but obtain those records, and they're not able to for whatever reason, and you get those records independently, is the lab held responsible for that, right? It's an internal discussion you have to have. What if the lab has demonstrated, hey, we've made two or three requests for these records and we never got them, and you make the request to the doctor's office and they provide the records? Do you hold the lab accountable for failing to obtain records when they're obligated to? Is that a technical violation, or are you treating it as something else? Food for thought, for sure. So you have to keep up with these things. The MedLearn matters, the policies and information that comes out, not just in NCDs and LCDs, but some of these things that come out from the MACs as well, really do help to streamline the ability of an investigator to cut right to the chase. So great topics. We're going to continue on. As always, I appreciate everybody joining us for this week's episode. And again, you can get our weekly OIG roundtable from the newsletter. Sign up for it on our refreshed website at VIZE, VIZE Health. at .com, and you can get that sent right to your inbox. Some great LinkedIn Lives we've got scheduled, and always we appreciate everybody taking their time, and we'll see you all on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.